From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Wall Street is welcomed back to Washington. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. After financial disaster in 2008, President Obama steered clear of fat cat bankers. Candidate Donald Trump roasted Hillary Clinton's ties to Wall Street. But as president, he's recruited a who's who of alumni from hedge funds, J.P. Morgan Chase, and especially Goldman Sachs as economic advisors. He says he'll relieve the financial industry of burdensome regulations. But critics are asking, what about all those promises to working people? Politicians and pundits may be demanding answers, but we'll hear that Trump supporters don't care about his advisors if he can make America great again. Later on today's Talking Point, the president blames illegal leaks for new reports about campaign contacts with Russia. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24, programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Donald Trump promised to drain the swamp in Washington, but critics say he's filling it with Wall Street bankers that they blame for the financial crisis of 2008. Do his working class supporters really care? Later on today's Talking Point, new revelations about the Trump campaign's contacts with Russia and another angry blast at Democrats and the media from the president. First, this news update. President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a White House news conference today before holding a private meeting. The president was asked if he supports the two-state solution as past presidents have.
So I'm looking at two-state and one-state. And I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. I thought for a while the two-state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best.
That ends decades of American policy. When Prime Minister Netanyahu was asked the same question, he avoided the phrase two-state solution and talked of a different approach to resolving issues between Israel and the Palestinians.
I believe that the great opportunity for peace comes from a regional approach, from involving our newfound Arab partners in the pursuit of a broader peace and peace with the Palestinians. And I greatly look forward to discussing this in detail with you, Mr. President.
The president said he was surprised to hear that. Ron Campius is Washington bureau chief for the JTA. That's a wire service that covers Jewish affairs. Good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about what President Trump said. That just sort of waved aside American policy, bipartisan policy that goes almost back to the founding of Israel.
The two-state, well, in terms of explicit policy being bipartisan, it goes back to George W. Bush's speech on the White House lawn in 2002. But certainly, yes, he did that. He retreated from two states, and he did something even more extraordinary, because if you're listening to people who are previewing this, there was a background briefing last night by a senior White House official. There are think tanks here that are close to the White House, or at least close to the Republicans. And they were saying, oh, this isn't really getting rid of two states. This is retreating from two states in order to bring it back, to put the pressure back on the Palestinians. If you want the two states, you have to come back to the table with something, with things that Israel wants. And then, the clip you just played, President Trump goes off on his own tangent and says, I could be happy with one state if you want one state. So, yes, that's a very big reversal.
Thank you for correcting my history. It only goes back to George W. Bush. But in any case, it's a bipartisan, or has been a bipartisan approach. Before he left Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu was told he shouldn't even use the phrase two-state solution. What does that mean in terms of his situation in Israel itself?
He's coming in under intense pressure from his right wing. I mean, most of his cabinet rejects two-state. They want to annex part of the West Bank. They're not too clear on what they want for the Palestinians, but there's talk of like autonomy for the Palestinians in the areas that are populated. They want to fulfill the promise of a greater Israel that the settlement movement sought to fulfill going back to the late 1960s. So you know he was seeking an out here. I think that the president gave Netanyahu an out first of all by saying, I want you to stop on settlements, because now he can say, look, the president wants me to stop. He can go back to his right wing and say, we can't expand at a crazy rate. And he also wanted to be able to tell his right wing, look what I extracted. They're no longer pressuring us for two states.
What does he mean by the regional approach? And has that one been tried before?
Yes, it has been tried before. As again, you know, you go to these, you listen to these press conferences with the current president, and there's all these things that are said, and you're thinking to yourself, huh? Because he said it was news to him. But in fact, it goes back again to 2002, and what was then known as the Saudi Peace Initiative eventually became known as the Arab League Peace Initiative, still very much alive. And it's a kind of outside-in or a simultaneous thing. In other words, Israel wants a more comprehensive peace. It doesn't want it piecemeal anymore. It wants to settle things once and for all. And the major Arab states, led by Saudi Arabia, are saying, "Okay, if you solve the Palestinian problem in a way that that works out to you know that we can say that we did our best to uphold the Palestinian people, we'll give you a peace from our side at the same time." And it does look as if there could be an increased opportunity for that now because of informal alliances that have been struck up between Israel and some of its neighbors in order to confront Iran.
All right. We just have a couple of seconds left, but no question that these heads of state are very friendly toward one another. They made mention of their family relations, and the relations were there to stand up and be applauded and praised. And Bibi Netanyahu has known Mr. Trump's son-in-law since he was a boy. So right. We'll see if any changes in policy come out of that. They're going to meet today. How long is Mr. Netanyahu going to be here?
He's leaving tomorrow. They're meeting for about 3 hours. I would say about the one thing that was a big takeaway.
Quickly, we're running out of time. Go ahead.
For my readers, was Netanyahu giving the Trump administration his blessing on the issues of anti-Semitism. That's a big no-no for the American Jewish community, and I want to know how that plays out.
Ron Campius with the JTA. Thanks so much. In a moment, Wall Street is welcome back to Washington on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with To the Point. Here's Donald Trump attacking Wall Street bankers in a web ad during last year's campaign.
It's a global power structure that is responsible for the economic decisions that have robbed our working class, stripped our country of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities. The only thing that can stop this corrupt machine is you.
That was then, this is now. Here's AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka on the first days of the Trump administration.
He promised that he wouldn't let Wall Street get away with murder, and he's changing the rules, doing away with the rules Dodd-Frank and doing away with the fiduciary rule, doing away with the Consumer Protection Bureau, or really are going to let Wall Street get away with murder and profit from it handsomely.
William Cohen is a former Wall Street banker. He's now turned business writer. He's author of a forthcoming book called Why Wall Street Matters. In Sunday's New York Times, he wrote that President Trump has welcomed Wall Street back to Washington. William Cohen, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Just give us a list, if you will, of the Wall Street people and the firms that they came from that are now advising President Bush. You're going to run out of breath.
I am, but most of them come from Goldman Sachs, which is one of the more preeminent firms on Wall Street, and I happened to write a book about them a few years ago. You have Gary Cohn, who's the director of the National Economic Council. You have Steve Mnuchin, who was a number two at Goldman Sachs before he just recently left. Steve Mnuchin, the new Treasury Secretary, was a partner at Goldman Sachs. You have Steve Bannon, of course, who the senior advisor to President Trump, who was an associate at Goldman Sachs, was there for 3 or 4 years. And there are a few other people around who also worked at Goldman Sachs. And, of course, the Commerce Secretary, who is slated to be Wilbur Ross, I don't think he's been confirmed yet, he worked at Rothschild, which was a private bank, before he started his own private equity firm.
Okay, so I obviously misspoke when I said President Bush. We're talking about President Trump today. You have written in the New York Times that now those people have a chance to make up for themselves and the problems they caused in the past. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, look, there was a time for the last 8 years where just the thought of anybody who had worked on Wall Street going to Washington was basically verboten. Now, that's not entirely true because the former Treasury Secretary worked briefly at Citigroup. But by and large, that was the feeling, the ethos of Washington was if you had anything to do with Wall Street in the last 8 years, there was no way you're going to have a decent job in Washington or a powerful role in Washington. Now that Donald Trump, despite what he said in his advertisement that you just played, has welcomed all these people back to Washington, all these Wall Streeters back to Washington, if they really care about the American people and they want to make sort of amends for what they did leading up to the financial crisis in 2008, by the way, which they have not done anything to make amends for that, if they want to do that and if they're serious about helping the American people, which they should be, then one thing they can do, which I've elaborated on in this article and as well as in my forthcoming book, is that they should change the compensation system on Wall Street to make people who work on Wall Street more accountable for their bad behavior. And if they were more accountable for their bad behavior in a way that they haven't been to date, then they would not do the kinds of things that led us to the crisis in 2008. And that would be an amazing thing that they could do to help the American people.
Well, now, what about this catalog of horrors we heard from the AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, Dodd-Frank, the fiduciary rule, the Consumer Protection Bureau? He says that the president wants to do away with those things. I believe both the fiduciary rule and Consumer Protection Bureau are part of Dodd-Frank. But tell us what all that means.
Well, basically, I think we have to sort of go a bit slowly here because and unpack some of this. Because
sure.
Obviously, the Dodd-Frank law is a law, which means that even Donald Trump, in his infinite wisdom, cannot just, with a stroke of a pen, put it in the trash can. That has to be, any amendments to that have to go through Congress, and that's going to be a long and bitter fight. The Consumer Protection Financial Bureau is now under the Federal Reserve. I think part of what they're talking about is not eliminating that, although that could still happen, but I would be surprised if that did happen, but trying to put that under congressional oversight where it is not now, and I think there's a movement afoot to try to have it have more oversight by Congress. The fiduciary rule is a rule. It was slated to go into effect soon, and that, I think, is probably something that President Trump can eliminate with a stroke of a pen, although he'd be incredibly foolish to do so. Because, I mean, the idea behind the fiduciary rule is that brokers at big brokerage firms, people who manage the wealth of other people, should put their clients' interests first. And I know that, you know, not to get too technical, but there could be a lot of costs and responsibilities for brokers to do that, but it seems so simple and obvious, and for them to, and one wonders why it hasn't been in place already, for them to him to eliminate that with a stroke of a pen is really quite silly, and there's going to be a huge backlash against it, as I think there already is one building.
If you were a client, you would certainly want to think that your broker had your interests at heart. Let me introduce Chuck Collins. He's a senior scholar at the Left-Leaning Institute for Policy Studies. He co-edits inequality.org as well. Chuck Collins, good to have you on our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What do you think of the chances that the people that William Cohen described as now being close to the White House and part of the White House in many cases will, in fact, make themselves and make big business people accountable for bad behavior?
I think it's a long shot. You know, we've heard the phrase Occupy Wall Street. I would characterize this as Wall Street occupying the executive branch and parts of Congress. I mean, I think, you know, if the goal is to address the people who've been left out of the economy, the half of the bottom half of wage earners who haven't really shared in the growth, the kinds of, you know, dismantling the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, unwinding some of the Dodd-Frank protections, you know, Williams' point, I doubt that they would really tackle this executive compensation system. I completely agree with him. It's one of the things we should be addressing. But I could see them dismantling the Dodd-Frank provisions that require CEO pay worker pay gap disclosure. Those are things that a lot of the Wall Street lobbyists have been gunning to get rid of anyway. So I think we're going to see an agenda that's really not going to serve the wider public interest.
My understanding is that President Trump has already signed executive orders indicating that he wants to change much of Dodd-Frank and the fiduciary rule. Would that be changing the fiduciary rule make sense, as William Cohen suggested? There is apparently already a building opposition to that.
Yeah, no, the executive order that President Trump signed was fairly general. It didn't name, you know, it was a set of principles, really, for regulating the financial system. But I would agree. I think it would be a bad idea to roll back the fiduciary rule. I mean, part of what we are trying to remember is, you know, in 2008, we had this economic meltdown. We tried to respond with a set of public policies and new rules and new oversight. It may have overreached in a few places, so we should fix that. But I think this idea that we're going to roll back what I considered fairly reasonable responses to the system breakdowns is, I think, you know, going to seed the next economic meltdown.
Chuck Collins at inequality.org. Stephen Moore is visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's a former economic advisor to Donald Trump during the campaign. Stephen Moore, good to have you back on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Warren.
What do you think are the benefits of the president's aim of drastically reforming Dodd-Frank, or getting Congress to do that, and taking other actions himself that we've heard discussed that would change it?
Well, I think that, first of all, most of the things that have been discussed so far about Dodd-Frank, the fiduciary rule, some of these other regulations, are things that Donald Trump campaigned on. I mean, he told people that he was going to roll back Dodd-Frank, and now what a surprise. You actually have a politician who's actually doing what he said he was going to do. So, you know, people can complain about it, but he was very clear to the American people that these were bad regulations. I work with him on that. I think Dodd-Frank, by the way, when we talk about people who caused the crisis, I mean, my goodness, the bill is Chris Dodd and Barney Frank, and there's, I think most Americans agree, there are probably no two people in America who are more responsible for the financial meltdown than Chris Dodd, who took basically, you know, sweetheart loans from Countrywide, which was one of the culprits of the crisis. And Barney Frank basically said a year before the crisis that he wanted to roll the dice on the financial, on the housing bubble, because he wanted more people to be put in homes, which those were all the homes that were foreclosed on.
Very, very quickly, Chris Dodd, a Democratic senator, former Democratic senator from Connecticut, to Barney Frank, a former Democratic congressman from Massachusetts. Go ahead.
They did nothing to stop the financial crisis. In fact, I would say they were the arsonists. Not the only arsonists, but they certainly had a big role in it. And then we asked them to write the legislation to put out the fire that they played a big role in starting. Now, look, my problem with Dodd-Frank is this, that it's been a classic example of the rule of unintended, of the law of unintended consequences in Washington. What we wanted to do was take some of the power away from the big banks, which are becoming bigger and bigger and more powerful. And more, remember, Warren, they were too big to fail. That's why we bailed them out. What has happened as a consequence of Dodd-Frank and all of these new regulations is that we're seeing the big banks get bigger and bigger, and the community banks, I just had lunch with the community bankers yesterday, and they are getting crushed, because what's happening is that there are economies of scale and regulation. The big banks, like Citi and like Bank of America and like Wells Fargo, can afford to pay for these exorbitant compliance costs. The small community banks can't. And what we're seeing across America, in large part because of, not only because of Dodd-Frank, but certainly this was a contributor to it, is, but remember, you know, It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart as the you know, community banker with his building and loan. Those banks are all being swooped up. The sharks are swallowing the minnow, and I would like to see a comeback, a resurrection of small community banks. They're the ones who make the loans that are so critical to our small businesses around the country, and they've been the real victims of Dodd-Frank.
Stephen Moore, once again at the Heritage Foundation, formerly with the Trump campaign. William Cohen, back to you. Why Wall Street Matters, upcoming book, a former Wall Street investment banker himself, but somebody who said that Wall Street needs to atone for the mistakes of the past. Mr. Moore says they didn't make any mistakes, and in fact, Dodd-Frank now has made things worse by giving more power to big banks and less to community banks. How do you respond?
Well, I actually agree with a lot of what Stephen said. I think that there's a lot of blame to go around in terms of causing the 2008 financial crisis, but a lot of the blame goes to Wall Street, not in a sort of nefarious way, but I think it goes to what I was saying before, which is the compensation system on Wall Street. Ever since a firm named Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette went public in 1970, basically when the country was focused on other things, that was the first private partnership on Wall Street to go public. Since then, all the big firms and even some of the smaller firms are public, and the whole compensation system on Wall Street was changed as a result of that. And so now people are rewarded to take big risks with other people's money, and that's exactly what they do. And instead, in the old days, they were rewarded to take prudent risks with their own money. That system is gone. We need to restore that system or something like it so that people aren't just rewarded to take big risks with other people's money. And
okay, so look, quickly, before we need to go to a break, Stephen Moore, back to you. We had the mortgage crisis, in part because of the sort of thing that William Cohen has just described. What about this issue of compensation, and should that be addressed in the law?
I don't think compensation really had any... Look, I do believe that there were a lot of bad actors on Wall Street, no question about it. There's no argument about that.
So shouldn't we have accountability then, which is what Mr. Cohen is calling for?
Yeah, well, the ultimate accountability is that those companies should go bankrupt, and we shouldn't have bailed out the bad actors. I mean, that was the big mistake we made, is that these banks that made these horrendous, you know, loans with, you know, close to zero down payments on mortgages, and people with terrible credit scores, and just making loans to anybody who walked in the bank, and then we, you know, the federal taxpayer had to bail out those loans. I think that was a big mistake. But yes, there were a lot of bad actors on Wall Street who took excessive risks, and I think it is prudent to have good regulations with respect to that. I would simply say I'm not so sure that Dodd-Frank has really accomplished that, and I think it could be reformed in ways that would serve consumers and our financial system better.
Chuck Collins, back to you at the Institute for Policy Studies, inequality.org. Do you think that they can pick the good and get rid of the bad in Dodd-Frank?
You know, my fear is that they throw out a lot of the good oversight structure that was put in place. I agree with Stephen that the regulatory burden on the community banks is too much. I'm afraid that's kind of being used as the justification to roll back reserve requirements, the Volcker rule that prevents bankers from engaging in risky bets, and even sort of weakening or gutting the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is the only agency that just, you know, focuses on consumers and protecting consumers. And we just lived through, you know, the Wells Fargo experience. Again, here's a bank that's, you know, ripping off its own customers and shareholders. You know, we need to have the oversight provisions in place. And my fear is in the momentum that I see, that they want to, that a lot of the Wall Street people inside the administration now would like to just roll back a lot of the sensible protective reforms that were put in place.
Okay. We're going to take a very brief break. We will return and continue this conversation with our current guests and add others as well on our talking point later. The president blames illegal leaks for all those new reports about campaign contacts with Russia. We'll hear about that back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Karen Olney back with To The Point, talking today about President Trump's embrace of Wall Street, and we want to go back to that in a moment. But first, Stephen Moore is only with us for a couple of more minutes, visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, former economic advisor to Donald Trump during his campaign. What about the Consumer Protection Bureau? We just heard Chuck Collins say it's the only agent of government that's really designed to protect consumers. Currently, it's in the Federal Reserve. There's talk about putting it under the Congress. Would that be a good idea? Would it be tolerable to Democrats like Elizabeth Warren, for example, who's made a career out of it?
Well, there are already five or six, you know, as with so much in government, there are already five or six agencies that deal with consumer financial protection, and that's just added to the number.
So it's not the only one, then. Where are the others?
Well, they're also in the Treasury Department. There are some, and the SEC. There are some. My point is that I think that one of the things I think we should all agree on is this issue of the three branches of government. And one of the problems is that the Congress, neither the Congress nor the President, can actually fire the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Board. So there's, I think, a problem of accountability. I mean, the Federal Reserve, none of us voted for anybody in the Federal Reserve, and to put it under that agency, I think, is destructive of the whole idea that government agencies and government heads of agencies are accountable to someone. My question is, who is Corduroy or anyone who runs CFPB, who are they accountable to? And right now, I think the answer is no one.
So do you think then that there will be wholesale changes in the Dodd-Frank legislation and the other issues we've discussed?
I do. I think it was one of the big promises that Trump made. It's an unpopular law. I agree with these gentlemen that there are some positive features about it, no question about it. But I think some of the aspects of that law, especially dealing with the community banks, as we've been discussing, need to be addressed so that we keep our small banks in business and they can provide the kind of loans that are necessary to rebuild our economy.
Okay, Stephen Moore, formerly with the Trump campaign, now a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Always good to talk with you, and thanks for being with
us
today.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Okay. Earlier we heard from Richard Trumka, the AFL-CIO president, objecting to all of the Wall Street bankers that President Trump has gathered around him. He also takes issue with Stephen Moore about what it was that Mr. Trump promised, saying that it wasn't to get rid of Dodd-Frank, although apparently, I guess he did say that. But certainly to protect consumers against the against Wall Street. I guess that would be fair enough to say that. Nobody would disagree. But Richard Trumka says that union members don't like the presence of so many rich bankers in the cabinet and the president's circle of economic advisors.
They didn't buy into that. And so those things really will increase corporate America and Wall Street's profit and reduce wages. And what they had in mind when they voted for change and a rewrite of the American rules was exactly the opposite.
So what did they have in mind when they voted? Christopher Borick is a professor at Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania. He directs the Institute of Public Opinion there. It's good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
What do you find out in this context when you poll people in Pennsylvania, obviously a very important state for the issues that we're discussing today?
Yeah, you know, I think there's no love loss among working class voters in a place like Pennsylvania, and we've seen that for Goldman Sachs. It's not a group. Wall Street doesn't play very well in places like Scranton or Altoona or Johnstown. At the same time, I think voters, especially white working class voters that came out in droves for Donald Trump in November, are going to give him quite a degree of latitude in terms of his selections of his cabinet. I don't know how much those voters are getting into the details of who these cabinet officials are, where their backgrounds are. Ultimately, I think Donald Trump's success or failure among that group is going to rest on what they see in terms of economic performance in those towns. He made tons of promises, really big promises, on a short time frame that he would turn it around pretty quickly. And they're invested in him doing that. And so I don't know if there's a lot of saliency for these appointments, although at the same time, these voters, again, have no love lost for those people that are on Wall Street.
You're talking about white working class voters. There used to be what were referred to as Reagan Democrats. They sort of fall into the same category, it seems to me, although in this case, many of them, I take it, are union members or have been union members. How long a leash are they going to give Donald Trump?
Yeah, it's a great point, and they are, and a lot of them are Democrats. When we look at the polling and the voting results, you'll see some crossover in significant numbers from white working class, Reagan Democrats, union Democrats, as you said. And I think they're going to give him some leash to play with. I think there's some realistic, pragmatic aspects of their politics that, yeah, even though he said he's going to do it almost overnight, that's not going to happen. But it's not a limitless leash. They're not going to let him go for a very long time, even though they are invested and have a connection to him. I think if you're not going to see performance in economic performance pick up in a lot of those working class towns and in those union towns over the next year and a half, there'll be a price to pay come midterms, and Trump's standing will fall. Right now, if you look at the polls, the same divisions that we saw before election in Pennsylvania are in many ways in place right now, with those voters standing by Trump while those opposed to him remain opposed.
Why is it that they are willing to give him this latitude? These are people who are very suspicious of government, it would appear. They don't believe government anymore. Why is it that Donald Trump, who made, as you indicated, all those big promises without any experience to back up the promises at all, why are they willing to believe him?
Yeah, it's a great question. And certainly Trump might not be the ideal model, if you will, of who would connect with these voters, you know, a New York billionaire with lots of connections to folks on Wall Street might not seem as the ideal. Nevertheless, his message, his rhetoric, some of the identity politics that to be frank, he played with last year and continues to play with as president, ultimately created some very strong bonds between these voters. Their lives in a lot of these places are less than ideal, right? Stagnant economies for generations, lack of mobility, you know, major problems with issues like heroin and opioid abuse. It's a tough time in a lot of these places. Ultimately, his pitch worked with them. It's not endless, as I said. I don't think there's a deep, unending well of support for him, but I think there'll be at least a little bit of rope that he's going to be able to play with.
You went to, or one of the places I know that you have polled is Allentown, Pennsylvania. It's often used as a place that's emblematic of the kinds of things that you're talking about. Tell us, who'd you talk to there, and what sort of responses did you get?
Yeah, I mean, we talk regularly in focus groups and in our polling in the state, including the Lehigh Valley, where Allentown is and where the college is. And you see a mixed take on it, right? I mean, Allentown is a place that looks a lot like America. When you saw some of the voting patterns last year, those white working class voters that have again seen in their view, a world that has passed them by in a lot of ways, are drawn to the message, his nostalgic approach that we can regain what we had, played with them to a large degree. I mean, there's no shortage of opponents. The county that we're in, where Allentown is, actually voted for Clinton. But within those pockets, those working-class white pockets that are still here in places like Scranton and Wilkes-Barre in the region, Trump scored very, very well. And there's a groundswell of support to at least see how he plays out as president.
Christopher Bork, again, professor at Muhlenberg College. Let me go back to William Cohen, our first guest, a business writer, former Wall Street banker, author of the forthcoming book, Why Wall Street Matters. You said that you were hoping that the Wall Street bankers and others of the similar ilk that Mr. Trump has gathered around him might, in fact, finally take responsibility for what's happened in the economy and become more accountable by putting their own money at risk, for example. Do you think that the kind of people that Professor Borak is talking about really care about that? Or are they much more interested in the big promises that Donald Trump made? And do you think he's going to be able to make good on those big promises?
Well, you know, I was fascinated by what Professor Borak was saying because I've often wondered that myself, why white working class people would put their faith in Donald Trump, who basically has nothing, no experience similar to theirs in their life, in his life, similar to their life. But I think that there really does need to be a deal made here. If President Trump fancies himself a deal maker, and he needs to make a deal with Wall Street, if they want the reform of Dodd-Frank that he has promised, and I actually do believe will begin to unleash some of the quote-unquote animal spirits that are so important to getting our economy revved up again and allowing Wall Street to do what it does best, which is provide capital to people who need it anywhere around the world, 24 hours a day, taking it from the people who have it and want to invest it. I think that's an incredibly important function that Wall Street plays, but I think in exchange for sort of unleashing some of that and unshackling Wall Street from some of the bonds that it's been in for the last 8 years, Wall Street has to enter into a bargain with, frankly, the American people and basically saying, we understand that we can no longer be rewarded to take big risks with your money, and we win when you lose. We all have to be in this together, and I think that if Wall Street agrees to change its compensation system and go back to the way it used to be when it was a series of private partnerships, and it wouldn't be that hard either. They're familiar with how to do it. I was a banker myself. I know how that system works. If they're willing to do that, then I think that would be signaling to the American people, hey, we're in this with you. We don't want to have what we did happen again. We want to make sure that this economy is humming along. We want to have it try to grow at 4%, which, of course, is what Steve Mnuchin and Donald Trump have promised, which is easy to say but very hard to do. One way to do that is to unleash sort of the power of what Wall Street does best, which is providing this capital, but it can't just be without accountability. And if that bargain were to take place, call that the grand bargain between the American people and Wall Street, I think that would set us up for decades of growth without the chance of bad behavior happening again, which brings down our economy time and time again. Without that, if it's just repealing Dodd-Frank, without that accountability, then we are absolutely destined for another financial crisis, and that will hurt the American people badly, and those people in Allentown who put their faith in Donald Trump will be sorely disappointed when there's a big financial crisis again.
Let me go back to Chuck Collins again at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits the inequality.org. What do you say if, in fact, the perception is that the protections against bankers and the protections for consumers are being wiped away? What about the animal spirits of the people who have sworn to resist Donald Trump? Do you think we're going to hear from them?
Well, I would love to see a grand bargain that William Cohen describes, and I'm glad he's engaged in the debate because I think that's his is an important voice. I do think, we established some of these rules as a result of the ways in which the animal spirits kind of got out of control. Dodd-Frank is a result of that. I think that there are rules in there that people are gunning for. They would love to roll back. And I actually have to say this idea that there's a sort of hoarding of capital, this is what you hear from Gary Cohn and Goldman Sachs, that there's money that's sort of being not put into the system. We're in a golden age of finance right now. I mean, commercial and industrial lending is gushing. Mortgage lending is almost back to, pre-economic meltdown. There are new heights in terms of credit card and auto loans. So there's
Dow Jones is at 20,000.
Yeah, there's a huge gushing of investment capital. And where there isn't, like in commercial real estate, there's good reasons we should be concerned about the amount of froth and speculation in that sector. So we need to have the right balance. I think, we rely on our animal spirits in terms of entrepreneurship and growth, but we have to contain we have to protect the real economy of goods and services. We have to protect local economies and local banks and credit institutions from the worst predatory aspects of Wall Street, the animal spirits when they go to excess. And I see a desire among the current regime to throw it all out, to unleash it all. And I think that moves us very rapidly toward another period of economic instability.
Chuck Collins,
none of us want.
Chuck Collins, once again, at inequality.org. Back to Professor Borok at the Institute of Public Opinion at Muhlenberg College. You said earlier that the Trump supporters don't really care who's running the show. On the other hand, how much, and that they are willing to give Trump a leash. But on the other hand, as we just heard from William Cohen, it's going to be very, very difficult, even presuming that the people around Donald Trump decide that they want to make the kind of bargain with the American people that he described, to pull that off. And the economy is changing in a lot of different ways. And there are big promises, it would appear, that Mr. Trump just simply may not be able to get away with. At what point do you think particularly union members and others who may be Democrats are simply going to rebel? And might that happen as soon as the elections in 2018?
No, I think that's a very fair chance that can happen. And those promises, I mean, there's no other way to look at it. The promises are extreme. I mean, he put it out there, especially on the campaign trail last year, in those working class towns in Pennsylvania, that he came back time and time again, that he was going to make changes that were going to have quick and meaningful impact on those lives. And those voters bought in, and they were enthusiastic about it. And I don't think they are all many of them are wrapped up in the mechanisms, the macroeconomic mechanisms that might deliver that, and the details and those important policy discussions that many of us would have. They want to see the change, and they're expecting the change. And I think if they don't, and again, given the high bar and the high expectations that he set, it's going to be likely that there's considerable disappointment. And I think, you know, we judge, presidencies at different points when the public has a chance to react, and midterms become one of those key points where we'll see. And I think there's more than a fair chance that if we don't see some of the significant economic growth that he has promised, by the time midterms come around in 2018, there will be a price to pay for his party.
We're already talking about all the expectations that have been created and about the next election. Christopher Borok, professor at Muhlenberg College, head of the Institute of Public Opinion there. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks to Chuck Collins at the Institute of Policy Studies and inequality.org. William Cohen, his new book coming up, Why Wall Street Matters, wrote an extensive piece about the issues we're discussing in the most recent Sunday edition of the New York Times, and our earlier guest, Stephen Moore, with the Heritage Foundation, formerly with the Donald Trump campaign. Great to talk with you all. Many thanks for being with us. The president addressed the continuing White House chaos and confusion today, and we'll hear what he said about it in a moment on Tuesday. The point. Warren Allen here with today's talking point. Last night, it was reported that Trump aides were in constant contact with senior Russian officials during last year's campaign. That's what anonymous intelligence officials are telling reporters. Daniel Benjamin was coordinator of counterterrorism during President Obama's first term. He's now director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This story is moving very, very fast. Since we've been on the air, we don't know what has developed. But bring us up to date, if you will. What is the latest? What broke last night? And what does it say about the relationship between the Trump campaign and intelligence officials in Russia?
Well, the key data here is that the New York Times reported that law enforcement and intelligence have ascertained that there were very frequent contacts between senior officials on the Trump campaign and others in other Trump associates, I think is the phrase, with fairly senior intelligence officials in Russia. And so far, they have not ascertained that there was collusion in terms of the hacking of the election and other sort of unsavory ways of tilting the election towards Donald Trump. But it certainly has, put up a lot of smoke and raised an awful lot of questions about what was going on. in those conversations.
We heard about General Flynn and the ambassador from Russia, and one of the issues there that made it so difficult for him was that there were actual recordings of the conversation because the Russian ambassador is monitored all the time. Does it appear that these other Russian officials that we're talking about now were probably monitored too? Is it likely that their conversations can actually be listened to?
It's a very good question, and I am not in a position to speak authoritatively on intelligence gathering like that, but I think that it's a pretty good bet if they had transcripts of the Kislyak-Trump conversations that they might have that too. So there may just be some information showing that those phone connections were made, but there may also be recordings.
Just to remind our listeners, yesterday, of course, President Trump reportedly fired Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor because of what was referred to as an erosion of trust. At his news conference today, the president blamed the media.
People are trying to cover up for a terrible loss that the Democrats had under Hillary Clinton. I think it's very, very unfair what's happened to General Flynn, the way he was treated, and the documents and papers that were illegally, I stress that, illegally leaked. Very, very unfair.
Okay, didn't mention the press in that soundbite, but of course he refers to it. Daniel Benjamin, how important is General Flynn to all of this?
So General Flynn is obviously important, but my own view, which I set out in an article in Politico, is that he is actually a rather small player in this larger drama that involves Trump's still unclarified ties with Russia. We don't know anything about investments that Russians have in the Trump Organization. We don't know anything about the long-term contacts he's had. This latest installment of news certainly raises a lot more suspicions. We had heard before that the campaign was in touch with the Russians, and there's just a crying need right now for more investigation. My own view on Flynn, again, is just that this is not something that I believe that Mike Flynn would have initiated on his own. I think that he was acting at the behest of someone else. I knew Mike Flynn a bit before he went into government, and I just don't see him taking this kind of initiative or being the kind of person to manage a large, complex shift in policy as the Trump administration, you know, has wanted to put in place vis-a-vis Russia.
Could that someone else have been anybody other than Donald Trump?
It's very hard to say. I mean, that would certainly be the first question. You know, there's more and more people are focusing on the role of Steve Bannon in the White House. You know, Paul Manafort, who was a who was running the campaign until I believe the summer, has longstanding ties in Russia and had done a lot of business in Russia and Ukraine. So, I guess the only safe answer is who knows.
You were director of counterterrorism at the State Department, and Flynn obviously was at the White House as the national security advisor. What about the impact of all of this on diplomacy in general, and what does it say to people in the State Department about how this government's being run?
Well, I think right now the government is in mode. The National Security Council staff is missing a fair number of people. The senior levels of the State Department are missing a lot of people. There are no deputies. There is an acting or there is an undersecretary for political affairs, but you know, none of Donald Trump's people, other than Tillerson, are there. I think the National Security Council staff is in crisis mode and trying to figure out who's going to survive, because a lot of them were Flynn hires, and that's not going to help them right now. And I think right now it's very hard to figure out who is running foreign policy. It is interesting that when they picked a acting national security advisor, they went to the chief of staff, a retired general, and passed over, I believe, four different deputy national security advisors who outrank that general, General Kellogg. So, you know, the whole thing is bewildering, to say the least. And, of course, the president seems to be at war again with the intelligence community. So, you know, it's kind of the Hobbesian state of war against everyone.
We talked a moment ago about possible evidence in the form of transcripts of conversations or recordings of conversations. Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, says he's afraid that evidence might be destroyed. Does that worry you?
I think that's always a worry, but I have to say that the leaking that we have seen from both law enforcement and intelligence suggests to me that there are plenty of people who are going to do their best to preserve copies of important documents and recordings. But it is a concern. And, you know, we all remember, what was it, the 17 and a half minutes or 14 and a half minutes of Rosemary Wood's tape from the Nixon White House, that long gap. So this sort of thing can happen. And I think it's good that Senator Schumer brought it up.
President Trump has tweeted that he's happy that Fox News isn't reporting this, as other institutions are. How important is this story? Do people really need to know about it?
Well, this story, the larger this story, is about Russian influence over the U.S. election and the ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. And I have a hard time thinking of a more important story. I consider the integrity of our elections and the integrity of our democracy to be a U.S. vital interest, as important as just about anything except the physical safety and security of the American people. So suffice it to say, I don't agree with Fox's position on that. In fact, I find it staggering.
That says it pretty well. I want to thank you very much for being on our program. We'll talk to you in the future, I hope. Again, Daniel Benjamin formerly was the coordinator of counterterrorism at the State Department. That was during the first term of President Obama. He is now director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. Great to have you in our program, and thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio.